Blog Talk Radio.
What difference if I hail?
San Francisco policeman who's also what I call a civic statesman. Welcome to the program, Rich. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, Rich, tell us a little bit about you. You have an unusual background. Your family this month was the anniversary of the Alaska Purchase, in which I think one of your ancestors was involved.
Well, that's right, Peter. Before I said, I want to thank you for your broadcasting.
Rich? Oh, yeah, okay.
Yes.
I thought I heard a reverb. No, go ahead. I heard it also. Okay.
The family that immigrated to the United States went through the Russian Revolution and had quite a history. In Russia, during the revolution, a lot of them were what are called decembrists, trying to bring all parties together. And I think that's pretty much what I have tried to do in my small way in San Francisco.
You were a San Francisco policeman during the tumultuous 60s, weren't you?
I came in 1966.
And they took us out of our gangs early to try to squelch the problems that were going on in the country at the time, race riots in Los Angeles. They started in San Francisco due to a tragic incident, and I think we did our best in the city to resolve the problem, fortunately without any deaths, but one that brought the incident to fruition there.
Yeah, and of course, your son is now in the police department serving honorably and all of that, so it kind of runs in the family.
Well, I'm very proud of my son, and I think just because of the history of the family. They were also in the Navy in Russia, and my brother worked for ATF. My father was assistant district attorney in San Francisco. So I think I headed in the direction of law enforcement for a short 18 years until I was injured and retired, and my son took up after me. I'm very proud of him.
Oh, that's good. Oh, Rich, now you were getting back to all the race riots and the terrorism. Your car was bombed, wasn't it? Is that correct?
Well, it was one of many incidences in San Francisco during 1970. During 1970, Park Police Station, I think it was February of 1970, and the reason I remember the month is things happened month after month in the city. At Park Station, Sergeant Brian McDonald was murdered. It was a pipe bomb that went off, and that was February. Let's see, in June of 70, I remember this officer well. Officer Radetich was in his patrol car riding a report, and he was shot in the temple and killed. In September of the same year, my car was blown up. Fortunately, as we were walking back to the car, it blew up. And then I remember another one because it's my church parish, St. Brendan's Catholic Church, where there was a funeral going on for a officer that was killed in the line of duty, and during the funeral, a bomb went off. Fortunately, no one was killed in that incident.
You know, these people have no respect. Now, one of the arguments that the radical left and the terrorists, the domestic terrorists, use is that the police unfairly target ethnic minorities, gays, people who are political dissidents or who disagree with the system, or who are what I would call far-left people who come to this country not to contribute but to co-opt and corrupt. Is there a are the police, when you're in the police academy, do they teach you a system as how to profile people that you legitimately suspect are going to commit a crime or in the process of committing a crime?
Well, that's a loaded question.
Okay.
I don't think there's a government agency or law enforcement association that teaches any abnormal profiling, such as race profiling. I think race profiling is something that is, it's a term that's brought about in a negative way, a negative tone, and very divisiveness type of approach to something that every citizen does every moment of their life. The moment a person walks out to their car, when they see a person, they're sizing the person up to see if they feel that this person is a threat in any way. That's one of the most basic human abilities that our senses give us. But and there's different types of profiling. You have offender profiling or criminal profiling, where officers are taught to look at behavioral actions of a person. You know, that person might look unusually nervous. They might be loitering, walking back and forth in an area with no particular intent. They might be dressed in an inappropriate way, maybe with a long coat or something, where they could be hiding burglar tools or, you know, something. And these are things that are taught in the academies and in government agencies.
Well, for instance, now I understand that a person has, like, traffic warrants, unpaid parking tickets and that, and he's driving along and, say, his license plate doesn't have a bolt in it, or there's no light over the plate, or he's got a taillight that it's out. Is that something that flags a patrol officer's attention, that they'll stop the guy or the driver? Would you call that profiling?
Well, in a sense, to be accurate, I think that when an officer is patrolling, even in these days where there are many, many things to do out there to help society, if they observe a driver that has an automobile that looks like it might be unsafe or has an out-of-date registration or a broken taillight, and they have the time to speak to the person, I'm sure that they would if they're doing their job. But I wouldn't call that profiling. I would call that a cause for them to do something. Again, if they have the time to stop the person and speak to them about whatever the problem might be.
Rich, is there something like police officers have developed a sixth sense about the type of work they're doing and the dangers and all the things that are around them, like a doctor would have a sixth sense about a patient, you know, he might not be telling them what's really wrong with themselves. Do you follow what I'm saying?
I do. I think about it all the time, and I really think that a person that is experienced in profiling, whatever their profession might be, there truly is a sixth sense. And I think it's brought about by using our five natural senses to deduce that something might be going wrong or something needs attention. It could even be a fireman, going by an area where there's been fires and they'll maybe look at a building and somebody will shut their garage door and look at them nervously. And I mean, there's so many situations where people in their normal course of life will use a sixth sense, which I call profiling, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, today, it's the joke is, like, if you're back, the California cops get paid too much. Do you know what the salary range here is in the state?
The dollar range in the state of
right.
California?
Right.
I don't. I don't. But having set off in 1966 to stay in a career my entire life and devote myself to helping my community, unfortunately, falling off a building 40 feet and breaking my back and leg, which eventually disabled me, I often think that an officer can't be paid enough to do what they do. I know in San Francisco, some patrolmen can make around $90,000, $85,000, and but I don't look at law enforcement as the type of job where you can put a dollar figure on it when you have, fortunately in San Francisco, pretty well-educated officers. A lot of them are college-degreed go into different aspects of law enforcement, and you can't pay them enough to do that job. I do think that some of the administration is paid too much, but I wouldn't argue a $90,000 salary for a San Francisco police officer.
Now, we're facing a decision, or the mayor is, to select a new police chief or keep the current one in his position. Do you think that a police chief should come from the community that he wants to be a police chief?
No doubt about it. I think knowing past mayor, Gavin Newsom, and having worked with him through his entire administration on various things, non-law enforcement-wise, I think what he did in appointing the last chief, which is he's now the district attorney, and running for election as district attorney, and then was replaced by a Jeffrey Godown, or I think his name
Guy from LA.
G-O-D Los Angeles guy, and I don't think he belongs here. I don't think he knows the community. I think it's a highly political appointment, but I do think that Gavin Newsom made a wise decision here, knowing that this was a temporary chief who is in a tough position right now, and he's going to be replaced, I hope, by a native San Franciscan that knows the city and knows the city's heart.
Now, I have to give you some of my history. 1959, there was a big scandal in Chicago called the Somerdale police scandal. And like, now Terrorville here is like the retirement, the pre-retirement station. Is that correct? What send the guys are getting ready?
I would say it's, you know, I know you, I want to hear your past too, but Terrorville station is an interesting station. They've taken a lot of officers out of very heavy, heavy stations where they need a break, and then they send them to Terrorville, and all of a sudden you're dealing with so many family arguments and suicides and stress situations that, yeah, it's a quiet station, but the officers are dealing with far more sensitive as opposed to criminal issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, getting back to what I was going to say, but no, that's an interesting side of it. What happened in 1959? Well, 1956, Richard Daley had the only serious opposition when he ran for mayor. He ran against a Republican professor from the University of Chicago named Robert Merriam, and Richard Daley the first barely won. No sooner did he get into office when the Chicago police, which was run by a Catholic, Timothy O'Connor, and the police chief's office was next to the mayor's office in City Hall, a scandal blew up called the Somerdale police scandal. It was cops who were getting ready to retire who caught a young burglar named they call him the babbling burglar, forgot his name, and they put him to work burglarizing houses, and they would keep the money. Well, the whole thing blew up, and the scandal was so bad Richard Daley was facing an election in 1960 and he didn't know what to do. So he was a very shrewd politician. A lot of people think those Dems and Does that he was a dummy. He had a law degree, and also he studied accounting. And he was a friend of, get this, Mayor George Christopher, who we both know and respect. And in fact,
George Christopher,
whenever he flew into O'Hare, there would be a car waiting for him. But anyway, what happened, Daley decided, well, he's got to cap this police scandal. And so what he did was he set up a community a group to put out the word around the country to find a police team. So they brought in this professor from the University of California named O.W. Wilson, Orlando Wilson, who had been a colonel in the Army and ran the police in the military police in Germany. So he was the head chairman of this committee to select a police chief for city of Chicago. So they couldn't find anybody, and they turned to him. And so the first thing he did after Daley appointed him was to move the police chief's office over to the police headquarters, which was 5 miles away. Then he proceeded to clean up the Chicago Police Department, and he retired in 1970. Now, I understand things went back the way they used to be. And, in fact, the joke, and Mike Royko, who was a Chicago columnist who I knew, I got in an argument with him once, he wrote this book called Boss, and it was very accurate. His description of Chicago police would stop a guy, and you would, if you were stopped by the police, you would have a fiver under your license, and if it fell out, you know, the cop, if he took it and he just slipped the five in his pocket to enhance his salary, if it fell off, he'd say, oh, that's my spare gas money, so he couldn't be accused of a crime. And there was a famous case of a black guy who worked in a kosher chicken shop, and he got stopped for speeding. And the cop says, I don't have any money, officer. And he says, I got a couple of chickens. So he gave the cop the chicken. That wasn't enough. So he says, you be back here tomorrow with a whole box full or else I'll come looking. But these things used to go on. And so Orlando Wilson retired in 1970 after about 12 years. And they've had
a lot of –
yeah, they had a lot of police chiefs after that. Then Richard Daley II brought in this FBI guy who retired, and they're still having problems in Chicago, all kinds of lawsuits. I guess there's two sides to this argument. Sometimes it's better to have somebody who, like you say, is from the community, who knows the city, who's walked the beat, ridden the cars, But in the case of Chicago and other, you know, L.A. did the same thing. You know, they brought in this guy from New York.
Yeah. I think that was pretty bad, too, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, it cuts both ways, I guess. It depends on the situation.
Well,
but
you know, Chicago's big. Los Angeles is big. San Francisco's a small town. But I got to say, I had the opportunity as a consultant for EPA, as a policeman traveling around the country, and had the opportunity to go to New York, Pennsylvania, Allentown, a great place, Chicago, and other places, and Los Angeles, and dealt with the police departments trying to implement programs for environmental things, believe it or not. But when I went to Chicago, I got to tell you, those are the toughest law enforcement officers I ever ran across. And thank God, because they got to be. When I went there, and I think it was 76, God, that was a tough place. And they were just starting to rip down areas that had been involved in turmoil, black areas and this and that, and really integrate the city and rebuild it and this and that. Speaking to the officers there, my hat's off to them. As far as the graph goes, you know, that's human nature. You're going to get bad people in teaching, as you know, in various religious groups, but you know, there's bad apples everywhere. Graft will always be here, but I never met a crooked cop in San Francisco. I think this is a tremendous organization here that is really out there supporting the public, highly educated, which I don't think you get in a lot of areas of the country, although you do get attorneys and highly educated people on all departments. San Francisco is very unique in that way, I think. They encourage college. And I don't know if you're pointing in on the corruption aspect, but it's everywhere. And
oh, yeah. No,
I have never seen it in San Francisco other than some petty things.
Mm-hmm.
Which the city's frowned on. I mean, you can't even go out and get a free meal nowadays.
bad cop, no don't.
Yeah, in my time, they didn't. You know, in my time, you went out and you always at least left a $5 bill or something. You know, nowadays you pay for your full meal. You don't take anything on the side, and I respect that. I think that's brings the community closer, and you know, I'm very proud of the law enforcement officers throughout the whole country. They do the best they can, and yes, there's bad apples, but you know, we'll get rid of them and continue to improve the system.
Now, we have some people who are don't have a law enforcement background, and I won't mention names. A couple of who are prominent city officials who think they should run the San Francisco Police Department or the Sheriff's Department. Now, don't we have a unique situation here where actually the sheriff is the top law enforcement officer because this is a county?
Well, legally, it's unique. He is the top law enforcement officer. He can walk in without the police department, although they would be in on it and arrest the mayor if need be. Very powerful position. But traditionally, his job is a very difficult one to take care of the prison system, work with the court system, work with social organizations that are dealing with the criminal aspects you know, that's enough. So traditionally, they've never had that law enforcement responsibility.
Now, Rich, you worked on term limits, and of course, we disagreed. I thought it should be across the board. Do you think that everybody from the district attorney, the city attorney, some of the other executive officials, including the sheriff, these should be term limited?
Well, yeah, I wrote it, and you know, over 70% of the community supported what I wrote. At the time, it was for the Board of Supervisors. The mayor, of course, his terms were already limited. In high insight, I should have included the sheriff. I think the district attorney. I still have thoughts about the city attorney. However, the way that I wrote term limits was probably the best thing my law guidance gave me, was to, and we consider this very reasonable, reasonableness being the strongest word in all law, I believe, is if they have an absence after the two terms, two four-year terms or whatever the terms were, and they went through one term without being in that office, they could return to that office. So I probably should have included the district attorney and the city attorney.
Now, Richard, if some of the when we had the earthquake in '89, I understand because the bridges, they were worried about the cars across the bridges and didn't have enough ferries, that a lot of police and firemen were living in Marin County, Novato, and all. Do you think that the city should provide incentives and maybe subsidies to keep to make it affordable for police and fire to live in the city where they work? Rich?
Definite no on that.
Okay.
And I have two reasons why. Number one, I did have a pipe bomb put on my front stairs, and I've never
That's
moved
right.
out of the city. Where, you know, my family came here in the mid-1800s. I think when you're, if you're working in the city and you live in the city, more power to you. But when you walk out to your car every day, make sure that you check your car out. And hopefully you're respected enough where there's no problems. But I've been through some kind of unique situations. I think it's great for a person to they have 10-hour shifts now where you can work 4 days and get 3 days off. And if they go across the bay, a 20-minute ride or 35-minute ride to their home, that's okay. It's unaffordable here to live in the city unless both parents are working. And, you know, that's a big issue that you brought up there, because today you have husbands and wives working. When they're both out there, you've got children at home. It breaks up the family. You know, there's many things in society that we have to watch out for. And the affordability or the lack of affordability for most officers to live in the city unless both spouse are working, it's just not there on these salaries. You need $300,000 to buy a house in San Francisco.
Yeah, unless
that in their pocket.
Right. Well, unless some people. Now, you are also in real estate. How do you now? Some people are saying that there's going to be a further a decline in houses, that people are really still mortgaged in over the value of the property that they're living in. What's your view on that, since you worked in the real estate industry?
Well, I actually was a director on the Board of Realtors in San Francisco for a number of years and ran their government.
And your family also.
Pardon?
And your family also, your mother?
My mom was in the business for 35 years, and so when I was injured, everybody said, well, you know, real estate, and so I went into it and learned the profession well over 30-some-odd years, and I'm in constant touch daily with the folks, although the market is such where, you know, it's pretty difficult for realtors, but to answer your question, I think we're in our last 8 months of decline. I see another 5% decline in the Bay Area. In San Francisco, it depends on what districts you live in. that are bad. The condo market has plummeted because all of these really well-educated and hard-working folks from all walks of life got condominiums, and their industries went under or cut back, and they had to sell their properties. A lot of them went into foreclosure, driving that particular. So those are very good buys right now, but the true difficulty is jobs, and without jobs, people are having trouble qualifying for loans. As low as these properties have gone, I would say on average, condos have dropped 35% to 40% in San Francisco in value. Yet you go to certain residential neighborhoods, and they've only dropped 10% to 15%. So it's all a matter of supply and demand, and there's a lot of condos out there. So I look at it positively. We're going through the most difficult real estate times, and I'm 66. I've never seen anything like this. My mother, who's passed away, never dreamed that this day would come. But it has, and I think we've got maybe another 5% in certain aspects of the market, and next year we'll see a turnaround.
Well, do you think this will be due that if we the America's Cup does come here, and some people are predicting tsunami beforehand, that this will spike the market? People want to come here. They come here to see that. They want to stay here. What do you think?
You know, I don't think I know. I've been around. You know, I've been to Italy, and I've been to England, and I haven't gone back to Russia yet. But I've been throughout the United States, and I'll tell you, I talk to people from Canada four or five times a week, and people from Southern California, and this and that, and we had. 3 months of rain, thank God. We've got a lot of water for the next year and a half. This is the greatest city in the world. And I don't say it because I'm a proud San Franciscan. I say it because of the opportunities in the Bay Area. San Francisco is kind of the middle of a hub of the Bay Area. It's allowed San Jose to have tremendous growth. They might even steal our San Francisco 49ers. But there's so much opportunity here. The weather is fantastic year-round. The worst thing you can get is a lot of fog. But the jobs are here, and it's a very modern market, and we definitely need a good labor force. So this is the place to be, and I have a lot of confidence in our future. And I do deal with agencies in the city voluntarily, like with public utilities and this. And we're rebuilding our Hetch Hetchy Dam system. We've got programs for enhancing the city and the city streets, believe it or not. I'm very positive.
Since you mentioned PUC and you've always been interested in the utilities and that, now the Bay Guardian and other radical leftists think that the city should take over, buy out Pacific Gas and Electric. What's your view on that?
I don't think it's as political now as it was before. I think that if the people that are pushing for a different system haven't read the law correctly. When the Hetch Hetchy system was developed, the Raker Act actually professed that they wanted to have competition, and they wanted to have private industry get into it so that we could keep city government, and let's face it, the biggest issue in the country now is government is getting too big. So I think it's great if you get someone in there that says, I can give you something for less. But I know a lot of people are down on PG&E. Uh, yes, yes, they could do a better job, but can a private industry coming in and competing with them? I don't want to get too technical, but let's say a private industry comes in and says, I can provide power and we're going to wield energy through the lines. I would be very wary of them being able to come out and take care of problems when poles go down and electricity goes out. So, you know, it's a very interesting situation, but what it shouldn't be political. What it should be up to is a private industry coming in and saying, hey, we've got a product, we can compete, we're going to take you on, and we're going to provide lower costs. That's going to take quite a while to accomplish, but with these modern technologies, I see it coming in maybe 50, 60 years.
Oh, I don't think we'll both be around. Well, the radical left.
Doesn't matter. You know, this is just a short segment of our lives.
Well, you know, Rich, we're both senior citizens, and I'm feeling I feel like an aging rooster. But, what I was getting at was that the radical left, like the Bay Guardian, want to municipalize the power. And my fear is, given their associations with SEIU and the radical left unions, that unlike PG&E, like you said, when there's a problem, they get out there. We just had a burnout last Friday, and it knocked out a business section. PG&E was out there with their trucks within an hour. I believe my fear is if SEIU types get in, take over and a municipalized power system, that they will throw a strike when they want. It'll be very difficult to get their people out there when we have a problem. And with PG&E, at least they respond, even though they screw up, like in San Bruno and other things, the nuclear issue down there at Diablo Canyon, that's controversial. But I would prefer the system we have, but just to make these people more efficient. What do you think?
Well, there's theory and there's reality. You know, and you have to realize in the 60s, all the way through up to just before 1980, I was taking environmental planning, sociology, things that people might construe as being liberal, but it gave me a lot of knowledge, and I dealt with a lot of people that have a lot of good ideas. I think Microsoft, you know, those people, they had some good ideas. You know, I never heard of a computer when I was in college. These handheld computers, you couldn't even bring them into class. Everything was done by hand. And, I mean, more power to them. They perfected it. And I think when there are some agencies or some theories that are realistic, they'll come to fruition. But, I think that solar energy is great. It needs a lot of perfection. It's extremely expensive. I think these electric cars are it's an alternative, but it's not going to work right now. Batteries pollute. The cars don't go distances. If you live in Chicago, I mean, how are you going to get to your destination if you're relying on a battery? Theories are wonderful, and they lead to a great future, but they need to be perfected before they're implemented, and most certainly private industry should do it. I don't think taxpayer dollars should be paying for it.
Mm. One last question, Rich. Getting back to police work, how do you feel about women working as policemen or police women or as police? So we have to be gender neutral.
I think it's great, and I didn't even look at that as a political question. I just think that certain people have certain abilities. I remember having a police captain as a boss. He was a great boss, and his daughter came into the department. She was one of the first women in the San Francisco Police Department. And she went into 3-4 years into the juvenile bureau, and I said, boy, she got promoted fast. So I talked to her father, and he said, well, you know, she began to realize where some of the needs were and how her abilities could help society. And she worked with youth. She worked in rape crisis, things that really men had always handled and handled well, but I think for a comfort factor for a woman, it's nice to have a woman out there. So there is a great need for women in law enforcement, and I really highly support it. I just think that everybody should be treated equally, and everyone at the same time should realize where their abilities are needed and how they can help society.
No, that's a good way. Rich, one last question. If you were talking to a class of, say, high school seniors or college students, and they were interested in law enforcement, what practical advice, philosophical advice would you give them?
To me, that's an easy question. Law enforcement is a wonderful profession to help society and to give. And I think giving is what it's all about. But they also have to give to themselves a continued education. Don't get into a job and into a rut where you are accepting a paycheck once you make it through the academy and go out on the street. Continue your education, whether it's just a bachelor's or a master's or a PhD. And I can look back on some officers, one of which is being considered as chief of police in the city, and he has a tremendous education behind him. I remember Chief Rivera had a PhD in criminology, and so that would be my advice to the high school kid. If you want to pursue law enforcement as a career, do not abandon your education. Continue to improve yourself so that we can improve society.
Well, I think every good cop, whether male or female, thinks that way. At least they have it in their heart, and they try to, when they're walking a beat or in a car or sitting behind a desk in a police station. Rich, any other final comments?
No, I just appreciate everything you're doing. Peter, you're getting the truth out there. Veritas must continue.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Rich, for being on the program, and we're going to play an interview I did with a former Yugoslav military officer who had some interesting remarks about the Yugo, if you remember that car, how we used to laugh at it. So I'm going to
make it and some don't.
Well, it was better than the Russian car, the Lada, and then the East German, the Trabant. And, of course, everybody thought it was really a Fiat. You know?
Yeah. Well, listen, I want to thank you, and God bless.
Okay, Rich, thank you so much, and we'll talk again. So now I'll play the other interview, and I'm going to hang up on you. Thank you, Rich.
Take care. Thanks, Peter.
Okay, we're going to play the interview I did with the officer who was in the Yugoslav Army, and he had some comments on the Yugo, which it's kind of humorous. So here it goes.
Have a little fun. Who came up with the Yugo? Because Americans laugh at that car. So a company in Yugoslavia called Dostava is actually behind the, obviously, they made the car, and it was developed in Zambia. And actually,
so it's not a Fiat?
No, it's in
what's that Russian car? A Lada?
Lada. some of them these days are apparently considered classics.
I know, people look at them as that. I haven't seen that one before.
For the, as the territory was being developed, as people obviously got more educated, and obviously they wanted to be different means of transportation, from a very, very traditional one to actually very modern. For the technology that they had, for the you know, for Yugoslavia, it was a car that people used it and, you know,
didn't break down.
Well, even if it broke down, it was so cheap, you know, so affordable to actually to fix.
You could get parts.
Yeah. True.
You know what they say about British cars?
Yeah.
You know, they like to tinker with them. They always break down. So I was thinking, you know, some Brit cab laid one on the Yugoslavians. But Tito? No, Tito wasn't around when that was built.
Well, it was, you know, it was a Stalo. It is even from the Tito's time, you know.
Oh.
But, you know, there were several cars, actually. There were even, you know.
Well, did he drive a Mercedes?
Sure. You guys, or a stage coach, who knows? I'll say, though, for us, what you guys actually had, which is Yugo 55, actually was the top of the line. The company actually that made it was actually a gun company, you know, AK-49, that is the Yugoslavian version of it, actually was made by the same company, which is Nostalva. So,
was it better than the German car? I mean, it was a nice German car, I forgot the name of it, and we used to laugh at that one because it was always...
Okay.
It was better than...
There's a small core, actually, that came, I think, from... this is a little tiny part. It's almost like, you know...
With Boxy, it looked like an older Fiat.
Yeah, they call it Ficha, you know what I mean? And so that's what we used to have, and that even was better than the Yugo. But at least did the job, the chance.
So was Yugo a name of, that they used to market it in America?
Correct. And even in Yugo was actually just because I guess obviously the name of the country, and they really wanted to sort of like, you know, representation of the country itself. Mm-hmm. It was the only car that was made down there, and so you wanted to have sort of like, you know, something that would symbolize the country itself and actually.
Good question. Now, in another interview, we're outside right now,
sure,
although we're not in Belgrade. Would you comment on Churchill's comment that there's always trouble in those damn Balkans?
I think there's a lot of different cultural ethnic groups that have been in the region for not just centuries, but not decades. We're talking about like thousands and thousands and thousands. A lot of pride.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people are attached to the region, to their self-identity and cultural identity. It's controlled economics. It's not really religion that causes these conflicts. There's been a lot of conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
But I think because of the territory itself, the size of the territory, and how many ethnic groups are in the territory, it's sort of like, you know, I think it makes it look like there's always trouble because it's so... talking about territory size, two states of the United States, and we're talking about probably 15, 20 countries. So obviously, you know, you would do that. But in any case, there's been a lot of problems. People do recognize themselves and identify themselves as Europeans. I hate to say it, in a few cases, a few times, you know, obviously, don't act as most Western Europeans because a lot of, you know...
Well, that's widespread across the continent.
A lot of solutions are handled in sort of like, you know, by force.
Mm.
But when it comes down to the economics control power, and especially in the case of Yugoslavia, each and every one of the republics would have its own identity and its culture, and its sort of regime in a sense, because then really it was sort of managed... power. They wanted to have control, they wanted to have dictatorship, and they wanted to have really, like, you know, economic power. The region has a lot of resources, it has a lot of great people that were brought up in different generations. In any sense, I'm sure Churchill had
like Tesla?
Yeah, true. You know,
his name's coming back now. With his energy crisis.
Sure.
And he had some great musicians come out of there.
I'm sure, yes. Gil Dukman is one.
Felix Weingartner. He changed his name from Dalmatia,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah.
And, of course, the wine was good at one time.
It's coming back.
Yeah, I have to see it first.
Every one of them now, like, you know, more so just like the Yugo. There's a lot of winemakers now that are
making
the wines in the name of the city.
Well, they were adding Retsina in the Bulgarian. I think it's Bulgarian or Romanian.
Yeah.
It's pretty bad. Well, Arvin, since you're getting a headache, let's continue this, and we'll talk about your military experience and some of the other cultural things, like some of the things you did in the military, and more about Tito, who's a character that we heard about, but very few people in the West really knew anything about him.
That's What's funny is that a lot of people don't know. He spoke seven languages, at least, like, you know, that's what we know.
Yeah, we just thought he was a thug.
No, he wasn't. And he never finished completely high school. He was actually a handyman.
He's pretty handy with a gun.
Self-educated and self-made.
Mm-hmm.
It's a unique character to study, and he was a great politician. Believed in making friends before you make enemies.
He managed to hold off Stalin. I never could figure that one out. A lot of people couldn't figure that one out.
There was one of the first, with Edvard Hoxha. There were the two ones that actually broke that sort of pact that they had.
You mean the guy in Albania?
Correct. Hoxha. Edvard Hoxha.
Oh, that'll be interesting in part two. So since you're getting a headache and we're still a little noisy. Thank you, Alvin. And we'll do part two, and we'll probably run this Friday. I'll just edit it a little bit, and I got your email.
I'm trying to be as unbiased and possible as I can.
How could you be unbiased? Thank you so much.
Right,
thank you.
That was our Yugoslavian former military officer, Arvin, and we'll have part two. This is unfortunately done outside. It was the only way we could do it, and it's not the most desirable environment for interviews, but I had to get that interview. Now today, the birthdays, we reversed our programming. We had Ponce de Leon was born today, and he was the guy went to Florida looking for the Fountain of Youth. I guess he's still looking. And then one of the great field marshals of the German army, he served. A lot of people don't know that the Boxer Revolution, when it was put down at the turn of the century. In fact, you see the movie 55 Days of Peeping. All the major countries, the British, the French, the Germans, the Japanese, and the Russians and the Americans were involved in putting down the Boxer Revolution. And the German commander of the force that Germany sent was a guy named Alfred von Dessé. Also today, the guy who founded John Hopkins, a famous medical institution in Baltimore, was William Henry Weld. And then one of the great British conductors, very elegant man, it's his birthday today, Sir Adrian Bolt, did a lot of music with Vaughan Williams, the great English composer, operas, and very, very dapper man, great musician. There are other musicians born today, too. There's about five of them. Joseph Cripps, who conducted the San Francisco Symphony, one of the greatest of the Italian tenors, a big, handsome stud. His father, he studied to be a naval engineer, and then he got into singing opera. Franco Corelli, then another great singer, German, Austrian, Walter Berry, born today. And then John Gavin, pretty good-looking guy, B actor. I think he was Reagan's ambassador to Mexico, and I think he's still living. Interesting deaths today. The first French king to be beheaded was a guy named Charles VIII. I didn't have time to research all of it, but he was 27 years old when they chopped off his head. And then Lorenzo de' Medici of the famous Medici family in Florence, he was born, died today. And we had Nijinsky, one of the greatest male ballet dancers of all time. He had affairs with Diaghilev, who was homosexual. He married a woman, and Diaghilev dumped him, and he went crazy, and he lived about 30 years mentally ill, and I think he died in 1950. But I think it was Picasso who did paintings of him, very elegant, a fine dancer, better than Nureyev, who died of AIDS, incidentally. Then one of the great generals, a commoner, Omar Bradley, last of our five-star generals, he died today. The first of the Borgia, the Borgia family was a Spanish family that took over the papacy. Also, Starz, the cable network, is featuring their series on the Borgias, the original crime family, as they call it, and they really were. They covered all the bases of the military, politics, and the Roman Catholic Church. And then we had the first Jewish synagogue open in New York, Congregation Charit. This was in 1730. And then we had the first fire escape patented today in 1766. And then on this day in 1865, General Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox, one of the greatest generals in American history. And then in 1913, we had the first direct election of senators. Senators used to be elected by their state legislatures. That's why there was so much corruption. Although I don't know if things have changed when we look at people like Harry Reid and Diane and some of the other sleazebags in the U.S. Congress. And then something interesting in Norway. Norway had established an active-passive voting system for women. Now, what this is active means that a woman could vote. Passive means that men could vote for a woman for office, but the woman couldn't vote for a woman. A woman couldn't vote for another woman for office. And then a great actor, I wish he'd ran for governor of California, Clint Eastwood was elected mayor of Carmel. We had, this is interesting, in 1994, smoking was banned in the Pentagon, but I understand they're doing other things, some of the, and they get busted for cocaine and pot. And then we had religious peace today. The Latin Vulgate Bible was established for the Roman Catholic Church. The Anglicans and the Protestants never accepted that. And then a great anti-Nazi, he was a Lutheran, Martin Bonhoeffer, was executed today, and his final words were, "I leave this. This is the end, but for me, it's the beginning." And he was one of the greatest clerics who stood up to Hitler and the Nazi terror, and it cost him his life, and he was martyred. So we'll end with our favorite theme, which represents a lot of things that go on in life, politics and poker.
What do you say, Ben? You want to have him?
No, you guys go ahead.
I got too much on my mind
to play poker.
Politics and
Well, good night, people. This is Peter Paul Brizola. We'll be back Monday at 5:30. Good night.